So I want you to come back in your minds to the first Easter. And you've been transported, not to Israel, but to Egypt. For the first Easter, the first Passover celebration, was in Egypt. God's people there are stuck as slaves under a tyrant, under an awful ruler, Pharaoh. 9 plagues have come and gone, and Pharaoh, the ruler, has kind of waxed and waned. Shall I let the people go? Yes, no, yes, no. And now we come to the eve of the 10th plague that would come upon not just the Egyptians, but on every single household in Egypt who didn't put the blood of a substitute, the blood of a lamb, upon the doorposts. Because death would come to all. The angel of death would come that night and bring death to the firstborn of all Egypt. So either it was the son, or it's the substitute, the lamb. You see, the sacrifice of the lamb changed everything. Absolutely everything. Because with that final plague, death to the firstborn, God allows his people to leave Egypt. He allows them to leave the tyrant ruler behind them. And they leave behind all the standards and the values that were there in Egypt to come under a new head, the Lord. And they move towards a new land, the promised land of Canaan. And God's going to give them new standards to live by. For as the people rescued by God, the Passover lamb, he brings them to himself at Sinai to give them the law, his way that the people should live by. And so from that day forward, from the day of the Passover, God's people walk with the life, the old life behind them, the life marked by Egypt, the life marked by sin and death, to the new life, the life with the Lord as the head, to the life that brings life and righteousness and peace. In the following years, as they celebrated the Passover, it was to be preceded, starting 7 days earlier, by what I'm going to call a spring clean. Hopefully on screen, if I can work this thing, we'll have... There we go. Exodus. Let's read Exodus 12, and we can see the spring cleaning that was to take place before the Passover. On that same night, I will pass through Egypt and strike down every firstborn of both people and animals. I will bring judgment on all the gods of Egypt. I am the Lord. The blood will be a sign for you on the houses where you are, and I will see the blood, and I will pass over you. No destructive plague will touch you when I strike Egypt. This is a day you're to commemorate. For the generations to come, you shall celebrate it as a festival to the Lord, a lasting ordinance. For 7 days you are to eat bread made without yeast. On the first day, remove the yeast from your houses. For whoever eats anything with yeast in it from the first day through to the seventh must be cut off from Israel. So before Easter can be celebrated, the ginormous spring clean must take place. All the yeast, all the leaven, must be removed. And you notice how serious this is. This isn't just, well, if it takes place, it takes place, but if not, no worries. Look at the last line there. From the first day through the seventh, must be cut off from Israel. You see, if you fail to follow the Lord's ordinance, if you fail to get rid of the yeast before you celebrate the Passover, you need to be cut off, removed from the people. You will be counted as one whom the Passover lamb was not sacrificed for. You could go through all the rituals, but you will be counted as one for whom the Passover lamb has not been sacrificed if you refuse to get rid of the yeast from within. So for us, as we celebrate the greatest, the greater Passover sacrifice, Jesus, the Passover lamb who's been sacrificed for us, we need to remind ourselves that that spring cleaning, not of the yeast, but of what the yeast symbolizes, which is sin, needs to be removed from among us. As we remember the greatest deliverance ever of Jesus from our sin and the death that that brings, we need to do that spiritual spring cleaning, removing the sin from our lives, pursuing holiness, both as individuals and as families and as a church family. Get rid of the yeast. Get rid of the sin that is among you, is what Paul is saying. So half when should we remember Easter? I'll let you think that through. And it's because the church in Corinth were not removing the yeast, not getting rid of the sin from among them, that Paul has to write this chapter. That's why he starts, as he does, with the problem in verse 1. I wonder if you can see it there. There's the problem, verse 1. It's actually reported that there is sexual immorality among you, and of a kind that even the pagans do not tolerate. A man is sleeping with his father's wife. It's shocking, isn't it? It looks like there's an individual, someone claiming to be a Christian in the church, who is sleeping with his stepmother. And Paul is shocked. He's appalled. You see, even in the Old Testament, this was forbidden. Even in Roman law, in Roman culture that was pretty permissive, it was, no, this is a no-go. You see, the point is that even a sexually tolerant culture, a very sexually progressive culture, looks upon this and frowns. You see, the point that Paul is making is, look, you don't even have to be a Christian to work out that this is not good. But there's a deeper problem as well. It's not a private matter. It's not even just a church matter. You see, Paul is hundreds of miles away in Ephesus. Miles and miles from Corinth, and yet even he's heard about it. You know, the Corinthian grapevine is pretty strong. The culture knows about it. The culture frowns upon the church. Well, that leads us to the wrong response of the Corinthians there in verse 2. Do you see it there, the first four words? Look at verse 2. You won't see it looking at me. Look at verse 2. First four words, the wrong response. And you are proud. They're proud that they are more tolerant, more progressive than a sexually permissive city. They're proud that they've made front page of the newspapers for the scandal that they're committing. And they're going, this is marvelous. It looks like the man who's in question is perhaps an influential individual in the church. Maybe he's a strong financial giver. Maybe he's funding the staff team, and a growing staff team at that. And so the church turn a blind eye to it. Well, you know, we wouldn't want to upset him. After all, he does pay the pastor's salary. And he's the one who's going to fund the new children's worker. So we want to keep him sweet. And so you turn a blind eye to the sin. Or they go, well, you know, this is Corinth. Just next door to where we meet, there's this temple of Aphrodite, and there's all sorts of wrong sexual activity going on in there. We can't expect everybody to be pure all the time. This is Corinth, after all. And so we'll just let it go. You see, this is the Corinthian attitude to sexual sin. And I wonder if I ask us the question, what is our attitude to sexual sin, how we would respond? Do we kind of go, well, you know, it's summer, And everyone isn't wearing much clothes because it's so hot. We can excuse the second, the third, the fourth look at somebody. After all, everyone else is doing it. I only watch things online. They're just pictures. It's not a person, really. It's just mediated through my screen. No one else knows. It's okay. I wouldn't do it in real life. You know, biblical gender, biblical sexuality? Oh, it's just outdated. We've got to move with the times. So if two people love each other and they're the same sex, well, we should embrace it. They love one another. We shouldn't stand in their way and say they can't have a relationship or they can't marry. If someone feels trapped in their body, if a man feels that he isn't a man because he should be a woman, we should celebrate it. We should embrace it. We should celebrate that we can have gender-transforming medication and surgery. Wow, it's good that we can be like that. You see, if we have any of those sorts of attitudes, then we've just fallen into the trap of the Corinthians. The world has come into the church, and the church has totally embraced it. Well, let's have a look at the right response. Verse 2 and then verse 4 and 5. Let's look down at our Bibles. Second half of verse 2. Shouldn't you rather have gone into mourning and put out of your fellowship the man who has been doing this? Think about going to a funeral. Or if you can't think of a funeral, maybe it's at the airport where you're seeing off someone, a really close friend, a loved one, and you're not sure when you're going to see them again. And your heart and your mind and your feelings are full of sadness and mourning, regrets. It's not a happy moment. Even though you might remember the good times, the grief is overwhelming you at the loss. That's what Paul says the church should be feeling at this time. Not just one or two people, but the whole church should be feeling that sort of attitude, those sorts of emotions, when we hear of such immorality. In the Old Testament, the prophets would often be calling Israel to be mourning, to be wailing, to be covering themselves in sackcloths and ashes, mourning their sin. That's what Paul says is the right response to sexual immorality, not tolerance and celebrating your progressiveness. So the first response there in verse 2 is mourning, and then in verse 4 and verse 5, it's discipline. Come down with me to verse 4. So when you are assembled, and I am with you in spirit, and the power of our Lord Jesus is present, hand this man over to Satan for the destruction of his flesh, so that his spirit may be saved on the day of the Lord. That's not very tolerant, is it? Excluding an individual from the fellowship, saying, for this time, while you are unrepentant of your sin, while you are glorifying in your sin, and you don't see the issues at all, you're not welcome here. You need to be excluded. You're not welcome to take the Lord's Supper, because that, the celebration of the Passover lamb being sacrificed, is something for believers. And if you are in this current state, refusing to even acknowledge your sin, then you are one for whom Christ, our Passover lamb, has not been sacrificed. So it is wrong for you to take the Lord's Supper. And it's wrong for you to join in the meals, because meals in those days were a sign of I am at one with the people. And you're clearly not at one with the people if you're glorifying your sin and refusing to acknowledge it. But do you notice, and I'm going to put this as a question to you, who is it who is to do the removal? Look at verse 4. And verse 5. Who is it who's to do it? It's the pastor, isn't it? Just the pastor or the elders. Yeah? Tell me then. Yeah, thank you. It's the church, isn't it? The church as a whole are to make the judgment call and say, this is not okay. This glorifying of sin, this refusal to acknowledge it, is not pursuing holiness. And the church is to remove the individual in question. When sin is known publicly, there needs to be a collective approach to the discipline. But notice as well in verse 5, it's for a time. This is not permanent. This is not, I am banishing you from the family and you're never to return. It's to bring the individual to their senses. We remove them from the fellowship so they go, do you know what, I really miss that. I need to own up, I need to confess my sin. It's not okay. And once the sin has been confessed and acknowledged, then it's welcome back to the family. There is restoration. Discipline is always with the purpose of restoration. This is what Paul is meaning in verse 5, really. When he says, hand this man over to Satan for the destruction of the church, he's saying, remove him from the church for a time. You see, in the New Testament, there are two realms of existence. There's the realm of the flesh, owned temporarily by the devil. The realm of sin that leads to death. Or there's the realm of Christ, the realm of the kingdom of God, the realm of righteousness and life. And the Christian is one who's been transferred through our Passover lamb from death to life, from the kingdom of darkness to the kingdom of light. And to hand this individual over to Satan is to say, I am treating you as though Christ our Passover lamb has not been sacrificed for you. I am treating you as an unbeliever until such time as you show otherwise. I'm handing you over to the world, to the realm from which you came from. So the discipline is for the benefit of the individual, for them to come to their senses. But it's also for the benefit of the church. Imagine you're in school, and it's winter time, and your child, or yourself if you're there, has got the sniffles. The runny nose. And it's getting quite a serious runny nose. You know, there's snot everywhere. It's getting to the eyes, right? And you're going and high-fiving the next person with the snot on your hand. If you turn up for school, what's the school going to be trying to say to you as the parent? You shouldn't be here. Because you don't want to infect the rest of the children. So that if that's the Monday, by the Friday, the teacher still has at least half a class, not one student left. Isolation to avoid infection. And that's what Paul is saying here. Isolate the individual, yes, for their own good, but for the good of the church as well. Because the church is to be a holy community. We are to pursue holiness. And if we let sin take a grip, a vice-like grip, it spreads. Sin is like cancer. It spreads. Left unchecked, it does not go away by itself. it can fester and it grows. So person A, who we know about but we turn a blind eye to with their sin in public, well, quite soon person A is kind of going, well, no one seems to care. Let me share this with person B. And actually person C is my friend as well. And so person B and person C have been infected. Well, they've got multiple friends as well. And so suddenly we've got it going everywhere. Paul says, deal with the sin now. Get rid of the yeast. But the problem with the church in Corinth is that they haven't. They've just let it spread and fester. And so Paul says, look, if you're an Easter people, if Christ our Passover lamb has been sacrificed, then that means that in the time before, we've done the spring cleaning. The sin should have been gotten rid of as we remember our deliverance from sin. But you haven't done it. Do it now, before it gets any worse. For the sake of the individual and for the sake of the church, both for its holiness and for its witness. Because what sort of a witness is it when the church is no different to the world? When the sin in the world is less than the sin in the church? It doesn't make sense, does it? We live in a world where we've got cover bands left, right and centre. Going from, you know, Elvis to ABBA to Queen. In fact, I remember seeing an advert outside the Corn Exchange in Bedford for Elvis. I thought, oh, Elvis is in town. hang on, no, no. I know I don't know much about music, but I think Elvis died, right? Now, we've got all these kind of cover bands, haven't we? But however good they try to impersonate the real people, when push comes to shove, they're fakes. They're impersonating, and sooner or later, the impersonating breaks down. Like best if we met one of these individuals who's impersonating to be ABBA on the street and they're not in their ABBA clothing, we wouldn't recognize them. But you see, you've got a church here that's pretending to be a holy community, pretending to be set apart from the world, gathering together like us on a Sunday, singing songs of praise to Jesus, having the Bible read, having a sermon, and yet festering amongst it is gross sexual immorality. And sooner or later, it's going to come out. Sooner or later, the world is going to go, you bunch of fakes. You're no different to us. And church is just your Sunday religious club. I've got my Monday tennis club. I've got my Tuesday bowls club. You've got your Sunday religious club. Hey, that's okay, but don't pretend that you're any different to us. That's why Paul takes this so seriously. Deal with the sin so that you're not fake. Deal with the sin because you are to be a holy community. Don't bring shame upon the name of the Lord Jesus and upon the name of his church by being a bunch of fakes. So how should we respond? Well, I guess firstly, it's to see the church as God sees it. We might look around and go, you know, I know people here. They're my friends. It's great. And I know people. And it's okay. Or you go, well, we're a pretty ragtag bunch. You know, we're just a group of people from Bedford or surroundings. We're nothing special. But that's not how God sees us. God sees us, however big or however small in number we are, he sees us as holy. That's how Paul started off his letter, to the sanctified, to the saints in Corinth. So if we are to see the church as holy as God sees it, we will be intolerant of public sin. We won't allow public sin to fester and to spread. So that's our first response. See the church as holy, which is how God sees it. Secondly, see discipline as restorative. See discipline as restorative. Discipline is not for the sake of the permanent removal, the permanent isolation, the out and you're not welcome back. That is not its purpose. Its purpose is restorative, to bring the individual to their senses, that they might be welcome back, having confessed their sin and acknowledged once more that Christ's death has covered it. And then thirdly, we're to see discipline as an all of us thing. Not the pastor, not the elders, not one of us, but an all of us. When I worked as a school teacher in New Zealand, our principal was a very, very good principal called Mr. Daly. And he constantly emphasized the all of us as a staff team. He said, it's all of our job to monitor the children's uniform. It's all of our job as staff to make sure that the shoes are polished. It's all of our job to make sure that the socks are towards the knees. It's all of our job to make sure that the language around the corridors is suitable. It's not one individual's responsibility. It wasn't head teachers. It wasn't senior management alone. It was all of us. Now, how do we do that? Well, it's not that one of us goes on a kind of a renegade crusade approach and go, I see the sin in your life. Out! I really don't think that's what Paul is on about here. But we've got accountable relationships in the church. We've got small groups. We've got one-on-ones that meet regularly. We've got twos and threes that meet regularly. And if we have open relationships there and go, do you know what? I'm struggling with this sin. Please pray for me. Or if you can't see a sin in your life, but someone in your little small group can, that's a place to point it out in love. Then if it refuses to be acknowledged, then we can take it further. But that's the place where it needs to begin, those small groups. And that's going to come from an attitude, a mindset of allowing other people to speak into your life. If you always have this sort of guard up, or if anyone says anything to you that might be remotely challenged, you go, rah, 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 and you just shout back at them. Well, that's the first step to being Corinthian. But if we allow people to speak into our lives, if we put our hands up and go, do you know what? I'm a sinner just like the rest of us. Then we can be in a position where such gross public sin doesn't actually happen because we're dealing with it in the smaller level. So allow other people to speak into your life for your sake and for the church's sake, so that you're not one for whom Christ our Passover lamb has not been sacrificed. The issue is not, do we struggle with sin? That's just the normal Christian life. This is an attitude of, I can do no wrong. I'm not willing to allow people to speak into my life. I'm not willing to confess my sin. There's a huge difference. And what the problem is here is the latter. But if we've got a mindset of, I don't really care. I don't really care about sin. Or my sin has no impact on others. Or it's not that bad. Then we're in danger, great danger, of ending up like the Corinthians. We want to strive to be an Easter people who each day recognize the need to spring clean the sin from our lives, and who delight in the deliverance that Christ, our Passover lamb, has won for us. Will you pursue holiness in private, and will we do it in public as a church? Let's pray. Just a moment for you to confess your sin to the Lord. And if you've been hardening your heart and refusing to acknowledge it, now's the time to realize that Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed.